Okay, so why don't we just start? So I just thought it was a nice idea to have a small discussion about reaction coordinates and collective variables. So let's write them down. So versus collective variables. So so the background that I had in mind is that we heard a lot about force graining in the last few weeks. And I would like to make the connection to rare events. So, I mean, if you have the famous length timescale plot, and everyone knows this, this is the law of time, this is the law of length. Everyone knows this. So this is the what we call the QM region. Here we have a whole atom classical force field. Here's the CG force field. There's the continuum. And you can actually fill in the length and time scales yourself here. But I mean, how I'm interested in all this length and time scale business is usually through the integration of along the time axis into the rare event region. And so this is actually usually done on the same length scale, but actually makes a jump in time. And then you can actually use this in for example, on larger length scales. So that's basically a two-step step idea. So I'd like to discuss what is precisely is done in these two, the diagonal route and versus the rare event route. So if you think about coarse graining, then I mean, we have seen this formula again, over and over again. We always think of some potential mean force being defined. And this is the integral over the coarse degree, the coarse degrees of freedom, and that's, of course, the same as the full Hamiltonian integrated over any time of coarse vector. Everyone agrees on this, so this is the mean force as the also force variables is the integration of the Hamiltonian in the full atomistic time description. So this actually leads immediately to this the log of this whole thing. So that's usually how people start, and then you can actually make an approximation that this is a sum over pair potentials. I think this is, and of course you can expand it to multiple potentials, but this is usually where people stop, and they find out the best their representation that actually does this. So this is all fantastic, of course, and I want to relate it also to dynamics, because if we are in the all-atom regime and we trust these dynamics, you want to reproduce these dynamics along this diagonal, but you can also reproduce the dynamics along this route. And what you then do is use...
Not everyone, of course, can want to reproduce.
No, that's okay. So that's absolutely true. If you're just interested, if you're interested in structural features or just thermodynamics, then of course this will do the trick. But if you also want to reproduce dynamics, possibly rheology or at least time scales in the coarse graining procedure, then you must have some sort of a coarse grained dynamics. So what many people do is actually is having a large event equation type of description, which is of course in my humble notation here some simple formula. This is a force, conservative force, this is a dissipated force, and this is a random force.
Peter, can I ask you a question, because maybe you know the answer, but so, I mean, Kent's, of course, like Langevin equation, and I'm even willing to settle for a generalized Langevin equation with a Mayer kernel.
But I was just about to mention that.
Yeah, but my question is,
I know only two cases where you can actually prove that you can go from there to Langevin. And one case is that when you have harmonic oscillators where H is very particular form, then you can actually do the usual Swanson Caldera-legged thing and end up with a Langevin equation. The second case is if you have a weak coupling, in which case you also get linear response theory and you get. Mm-hmm. But beyond that, is there any sound basis for writing Langevin equation or even generalized Langevin equation, or is just a model?
Well, of course, I mean, I think that's what this whole Maurice Sonsek approach is about, like,
Maurice Sonsek is a little different, so it's not exactly the same. The Langevin equation you get there is different Langevin equation from the one that you wrote.
Oh, okay, well, I mean, I just wanted to say that this is actually, the level that that I wanted to discuss here. I mean, you just assume a simple diffusive equation of motion where you just say I replace all the dynamics by just an effective diffusion of friction.
But Eric von der Leyen talked about this 2 weeks ago where he showed an alternative approach to the Maurice Sonsek and showed that you basically end up with equations of this kind.
Yes.
And of course, descriptions for how to get the noise and the friction, which might be very complicated functions of the original.
Yes. I didn't want to go into this whole complicated discussion because, I mean, I just wanted to point out that it should be in principle possible to come up with a dynamical framework for these type of coarse grains.
Well, but I think it's a very important issue because how do you come up with,
I think that is a different discussion.
All right.
It actually all boils down to finding which are the slow and which are the fast variables. And you assume here that these are slow variables and these are fast variables. And we somehow put that all in, and then we also make this huge assumption that everything is Markovian, and we make this Markov assumption that there's no memory effect, and then you can actually just use the Einstein relation. Okay, so I think what I wanted to say is that this would be a framework that I would possibly use, and you can even do an overdamped approximation, so you just have a effective diffusion friction and use that with an effective potential, and then describe the overdamped unit. Now, the thing that I wanted to compare it to was actually how you do it in the rare event limit. So where we actually have a phase space, but now we're actually looking at it from the perspective of a trajectory, which actually visits several stable states in a long time, and of course it can also come back to the same state. And here you immediately assume the so-called operation of timescales, and this means that this particular length of the trajectory in time, the molecular one, is much smaller than the relaxation time or the time in the stable state. So this is a bit rough. I mean, I just want to show basically that you can do this separation of time scale is if these are genuinely stable states. Now,
I'm sorry to be a pain in that.
But
when you say slow and fast, do you know exactly what it means? In the first part.
No. I mean, this is of course not. You don't know exactly what it means. We just assume it's the case. I mean, if you just, if for example, you would have large particles in a fluid of small particles, that would be the simplest description of something that you want to coarse grain. And so the slow variables are the position of these large things, and the fast variables are the positions of these small things. And I mean, I'm not going to tell you that there's no other ordinance that also smoke.
No, but no, my question is simple. So can you write exactly what time scales you want to compare? When you say slow and fast, what are the time scales?
No, you can't. I don't think you can.
In the rare event case.
In the rare event case, you can. You can, because you already assumed this. You actually started.
No, but this is so this exactly condition is not the same as the condition here. And, you know, famous example, for example, if you have memory in your Lagrangian equation, that's going to have a huge effect on your dynamic prefactor, right?
Yes.
So you cannot simply say that my memory is shorter than the rate, inverse rate of my reaction, right? That's not correct time scale separation.
Well, if you have memory, then you just basically forgot to account for a slow variable, right?
Yeah, in fact, Paul exactly showed that that's true. If you have a generalized Langevin equation, it means that it always corresponds to a case, a multidimensional case where you didn't rotate the coordinate the proper way.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm not yet already connecting this part to this part. So, I mean, if you want to, I mean, I put them next to each other, but they don't follow from each other. These are two different ways.
There's a pragmatic case. I mean, if you look at the big coordinates and the small medium, then this big coordinates move much, much more slowly than the little ones. But of course, I could look at a situation where I have a whole size distribution, where the biggest ones in my distribution are the big ones, and the smallest ones are the small ones, and then I have a whole spectrum of sizes. If I look at this whole spectrum, there's no easy way how to cut and say, okay, there's a lot of stuff on this side of my time scale, and there's a lot of stuff on that side, and nothing in between, which is the case here. If there's a whole spectrum, you can't just easily separate.
So no, that would be a...
The time scale separation is something which somehow the system has to be nice to you, that there's a whole empty region in time scale where you have to cut.
And this also is true indeed for systems with hierarchical time scales, such as biomolecules and so on. So everything is not so easy as I draw here.
Well, even,
I try to.
I buy the whole thing with the coarse gradient at that point for the statics. The problem is with the. I mean, the question is even if it's a well-posed problem, because in your simple example, as soon as you got rid of that solvent, let's say you could do it, which is okay, then you've blown away hydrodynamics.
Yes.
And the problem is, therefore, the whole. Your whole premise, to my mind, for that problem, is fails immediately.
Okay. Well, then, of course, I mean,
if you're coarse grading the way the polystyrene is done in a bulk polystyrene, I'll buy it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Super atoms for individual atoms. There's a potential, but if that's your example, then I would say your premise
then
fails immediately because if you throw away those particles, you've thrown away hydrodynamics. And you can't get it back, ever. Really.
That's a good point. I mean, officially you can write it back by integrating out of all the correlation functions. So you have to put in all the numbers.
You'd never be able to do that.
I wonder whether a proper Moritz one would give you as one of the things coming out of this Moissan tensor.
It does.
Well, in that case, it will come out of the formal treatment.
Yeah. Well, the formal treatment will give you it, but it is.
Well, but it's not in free energy.
It's not in here, and it's also not in here. I mean, you have to use this the full memory kernel for that.
Right. It's not in that simple.
It's not simple.
Once you write that simple thing down, it won't.
No. This is. I completely agree.
The memory kernel. We're seeing this instantaneous.
Yeah, that's true. Okay.
I think the problem is the way. The last equation, Langevin, is not related to the other things you've written up there. This is just a static prescription. Right. The last equation, that's, as you said, comes out of Moritz Wanzek.
Yeah.
And then Moritz Wanzek has to tell you how to get the gammas of the beta and the F.
Yeah.
You basically said how to get the F, but not yet how to get it.
Yeah, the F comes from the, just to make sure, this is, of course, the R, right?
Plus possibly other terms, as Gary just pointed out.
But if you do this properly, then you can just do this, of course. And but then you have all the other terms that...
Just a technical note, I believe that Moritz Wanzek does not give you that equation. It actually gives you a very different F, which is always linear. And so...
Which is what?
Which is always linear. So Moritz Wanzek is a different construct. It's not exactly corresponding to this.
But it should, I mean, eventually...
It looks like this, but it's not this.
So maybe you should stop now. Yeah, okay, but I so what I wanted to do is actually to say, well, if you could actually write down this equation, I mean, you still have to make this choice of the large r and small r. And so the question is, how do you do that? And you might as well say, I mean, you need to choose it such that you can actually come up with such an equation. But I mean, was said just a minute ago, I mean, then you need, even in the simplest case, you already leave out the hydrodynamics, so that must be wrong. So, but maybe I should actually continue with this particular part. But here, because what you do here is actually when you focus on two states, you actually also usually have a free energy profile, let's call it f of q now. And this f of q is exactly obtained in this way by just integrating out the, I can just write it down again for clarity or confusion. Something like that. Yeah. Of course, you need now also the Q's here, I think. Thank you. I forgot the delta function. Q, R, Q, F, R. That's how it is, yeah. So this is the projection from all the small parameters, the small coordinates of the whole system towards your collective variable Q, and you weight that with the Boltzmann factor, and that gives you the All right, and then what you can also do is immediately write a dynamical rate constant for that, like KAB. And that's, for example, in the transition state theory, you can actually assume that it's the probability to be on top of the barrier divided by the probability to be in A. And this is just something that I'm not going to write. You just have to times some sort of a correction factor. You have to do with how fast you actually travel along the reaction coordinate.
That equation really makes some sort of assumption that you have a Lomachenko equation underlying it with a constant diffusion coefficient that's not dependent on Q.
No, this is actually it's a transition state theory assumption. It just says that if you are on top of this barrier, which is a probability, and that's hence a thermodynamic quantity, and this is gives you the dynamics, which actually says if I go in this direction, I go to the.
But subject to what dynamics in the question? You have to make an assumption about the dynamics of the question.
Well, the dynamics is in this Q dot, of course. So. I mean, you have to do it. Yeah, you're right. I mean, I assume basically that I have some underlying dynamics over here, which I didn't specify. So, could be Lomachenko dynamics or MD.
But what's written there is just transition state theory.
Yeah. So I mean.
So you don't want to multiply it by factor.
Yeah. So I mean, the true one has this is correction factor. I don't want to. This is the transmission coefficient, which actually corrects for recrossings.
That's where the dynamics comes in.
And here is, well, I mean, I think there's dynamics involved. I mean, even the transition state theory already has some dynamics.
Well, but that is just a Boltzmann canonical average.
It's a canonical average. Yeah, so it's not going to depend on anything. Not on the trajectories, but on top of the fusion.
Is that a special case of the splitting probability and stuff like that?
No, this is just the old-fashioned transition state theory with dynamical corrections, which says if I'm trying to cross a barrier, I might actually sometimes not cross the barrier and I return. So these are unsuccessful attempts. And you assume that if you have a perfect barrier like this, that all of these trajectories actually normally would continue to the final state. But if you choose it in a little bit in the wrong way, then you can actually, then that will not be the case. And that has to do with these, the choice of order parameters. So this actually comes back to the pictures that I drew last week on the, so if this is your order parameter and this is your landscape, and let's call it A and this B for a moment, then you have these, this is then a settle point, which is actually pretty nice. So this is the so-called dividing surface, which will go, which actually separates one state from the other. And these could be other coordinates, for example, like in this case, solvent coordinates. And that means that if you are sitting on this line here, each of this line actually is really on the edge of a of a ridge in phase space almost, or in compression space, which actually separates one state from the other. So it's like you're sitting on the Rocky Mountains, and on one side you get close to the east, and on the other side you're close to the west. And you can actually test that by the so-called committer analysis. I also showed it yesterday, or last week on Tuesday. But if you have a point here, then you can actually start lots of trajectories from that point. And this is, of course, very operational. But you can actually calculate the fraction of points that go to B. And so this is the sum over all these functions. So suppose that half of them go to B. So this one goes to B, and this one goes to A. And then for this particular case, P is a half. And then you can do that for each of these points here, and then you make a nice histogram. This is the probability of this PV. And this will show you a feed like that. Now, this means that you have chosen your Q. Q is pretty good here. And that means that all your dynamics actually isn't intact. So you haven't assumed anything wrong in mind.
I'm not sure that is true. I mean, we're back to what I said, the splitting probability.
Yes. This is the splitting probability.
But the ridge is not where the splitting probabilities are half.
Well, if you have this, if this is true, no, I mean, if this is the correct coordinate, then your splitting probability will be PD half here.
That's not true. That's only true in the approximation that at the ridge you're asymmetric and B fairly deep. But if this is a weak barrier and one is different from the other, the splitting probability will have the maximum point. Even in a one-dimensional problem, it's not the same thing.
Yeah, but doesn't this whole ansatz make sense if you have a weak barrier?
But
this theory is for.
The theory is for not weak barrier.
Well, I don't yet know what the theory is for, but well, it makes sense to ask the splitting probability question even if the barrier is not big.
Right. Things like coordinate dependent diffusion can move it and stuff like that.
Sure. Yeah. I'm not saying it's true if you have these type of dynamics where the barrier is high compared to the actual.
I mean, if I have a here, please. Sorry, our ceiling lights can't pick your voice up very well, and I'd like to mic you up.
That's too much. Mic him up.
Too late. I'm almost finished.
Who's the next speaker?
Oh, there is no next speaker. No, we don't have a. Supposed to be informal.
We'll be up there for a while here.
I was hoping to stop that thing. I leave too much.
You don't want me, you just pretend.
Okay, well. Now the other, I mean, just to show you the other extreme, and I think that, I mean, this is all maybe already redundant in this discussion, but if this is the other extreme example, over here is A and there is B. And this is now Q prime and Q. And here you clearly do have a
the wrong idea of the objective variable. If you think that Q is your only variable here, and this line here will describe this precisely this dividing surface, now clearly, these ones might actually go to A, but they're very rare, and the most population is over here, so all of your trajectories will go to B, and that means that your histogram will look something like this. And this is indeed sort of the standard test for saying I'm missing out some degrees of freedom that I should have put in my description when I was looking at this barrier. And so to remedy that, you can just say I'm going to put in this as a as an extra coordinate, and try to describe my free energy landscape now in two dimensions, for example, and see if that makes much more sense. And then you can say, well, maybe this is the dividing surface. And indeed, if you do such a thing, you actually immediately recover this this behavior. So I think in the rare event community, it's now quite clear that this analysis sort of gives you a way to put in a better reaction coordinate. It's not a way to come up with a reaction coordinate, but it's a way to test reaction coordinates. And I was wondering, so one of the open questions was, now can we now use these type of tests or IDs and actually come up with an R which makes sense on a coarse-grained level? I think that's actually the question that I wanted to pose to you, and not answer it, of course. So maybe if anyone has any comments on that, or
one of the things that might be useful is to point out, what happens if you take this bad coordinate and try and develop a coarse-grained dynamical model of this, of say dynamics along Q.
Right.
Right. When it's a bad coordinate, you get dynamics that don't resemble the dynamics in the real system. Even though the thermodynamics, of course, grading from the thermodynamic perspective might be perfect, you get the wrong dynamics in Q as an artifact of what's happening in Q.
Yeah. Okay, so maybe it's also a good idea to first look at the correct coordinate. So here you expect, if you replace it by a one-dimensional potential such as here, and you do the Langevin dynamics over there, you sort of expect that the diffusion along this coordinate, well, let's do it like that, is sort of constant. So that means that if I look at my d of q, that would be the best, would be sort of constant, and so that my my dynamics really is described by this equation there. Now, if you then try to do that over here,
but d of q, and you've got a free energy that has a maximum.
So this means
what is d of q?
This means that the diffusion, the local diffusion, so the local friction due to the which occurs in the underlying system, if you project that to this q parameter, it is actually just a constant. It's just the diffusion constant of the system. So this is okay. I mean, if this happens. It might be varying a little bit, but it should be reasonably well described. In fact, in the diffusive limit, you can actually use Kramer's expression, which is just this, divided by and times some p vectors involving the frictions or something like that. I don't know, but this is the diffusion constant of the whole system, and of course usually it's assumed that it's only it should be constant on the top, but in fact it can be constant all over the
just plane. Notice that you're a Dutchman and you call him Kramer's, so that's the way we should be saying it. Kramer.
Kramer's. It's I'm sorry about that. Let's just say I don't. Yeah.
I was
going to
come here tonight. I thought you were a voice of authority in the native tongue there.
Yeah, we also say on the well. Anyway,
Don't say that.
I'm just joking. What was I supposed to say? Okay, so, I mean, your point was bare that if you look at the same situation here, then your diffusion constant will not look like that at all. I mean, it will be extremely, the diffusion over here will be completely different from the diffusion in this case. So here you would have a, I would say, I mean, I'm not entirely sure you have to plot it really properly, but I guess it goes down dramatically and then goes up.
How would you test that? You basically, the question is my observed dynamical behavior be compatible with a diffusion in that potential with some value of a constant of a diffusion constant that's
predicted? Yeah.
How would one test that?
How would one test that?
Look at a trajectory and then ask a conceivable outcome of a plain vanilla diffusion process.
Yes.
And you say the answer is no, because that would.
It actually is just, I mean, if you're, I mean, you can write this Langevin equation and just see if your whole trajectory is reproduced by that particular Langevin equation.
Well, trajectories, every trajectory instant, so you would, I mean, you have one trajectory that comes out of the computer. Now you have to make a decision. Do I believe that that's the result of a particular diffusion?
Yeah, but of course the, I mean, what should be reproduced is one, this thing, which of course it should be because it's you put it in. But second of all, the dynamics of the kinetics should be, well, I mean, the true kinetics should be reproduced, and that can actually only be true if you use the correct diffusion constant. And if you use the diffusion constant of this process in this reaction coordinate, you have to, I mean, it will totally fail.
Well, maybe my question is, you have to test it. What kind of database do you have to do this under? If you can do this process where you can simulate this back and forth like two guests, then you could have probably enough data to somehow.
Yes. Yeah.
But the problem is, of course, that all these rare event simulations, you never have infinite statistics. You just maybe have just two realizations of a crossing event.
Okay.
Now you ask yourself, hey, is this a...
Well, I mean, one of the goals of the whole rare event sampling is to come up with more statistics on the barrier. So you do non-Boltzmann sampling to actually elevate your statistics there.
You can do an important sampling to compute the diffusion as a function of the coordinate as well, by getting a local mean square displacement around the mean drift.
Okay, so that's for instance one thing.
See, I personally think that, you know, I can give an example, but I really think that people who worry about coordinate dependence of the diffusion constant are worried about the curtains on the Titanic, because that's usually memory is what kills you, not the coordinate dependence. So unless you're really lucky.
But isn't that intimately connected?
Sure. Yeah.
Memory and coordinate dependence, when you think of macromolecular systems, or things he is really interested in.
Sure, yeah. But I mean, it's not right just to put in some kind of coordinate dependence and hope that it's going to fix everything.
But that's part of the...
But he doesn't want to put in coordinate.
That's part of the main point, right? So you can pick a Q, and you can compute a free energy, and you can compute a diffusivity, but the Shmolkowski equation that comes out of that won't describe the real dynamics, because both quantities are not representative of the barrier that has to be crossed in the dynamics that are occurring along the right direction. You just picked the wrong direction. And so it is the curtains on the Titanic in a sense, but you know, it's sort of the recipe for how to do things if you have the right coordinate in the beginning, and then reality we often don't, right? Which gives you the
memory. I'm not even sure what, you know, do you want to give an example to challenge the whole
thing? Yeah, sure. I mean, why not?
I might find this like example might appeal to some people because it's a classic example.
This is supposed to be a discussion.
This is a classic example that is in textbook. So take a Rouse model of polymer dynamics. Okay. So Rouse model means that you have a polymer chain that it's just a bunch of balls connected by springs, okay? And the whole thing floats in solution, and there is no hydrodynamic interaction, okay?
So, and what I want to know...
In solution, in a melt. In solution, it's wrong.
I'm just saying that I take the model.
Okay.
I know that it's wrong, but it's a model.
You can melt as a viscous background.
Yeah, sure, you can take it off. But I'm just... What I'm saying is that the equation that describes it, you see the Langevin equation in this case, right? Okay, so now I want to know the following. So here's my reaction. My reaction is that, imagine that there's a short-range attractive potential between these two guys. Okay? So the reaction is going to be that we're actually going to see each other. So my product is going to be this. Now, if I take this quantity R, the distance between the two things, it's my reaction coordinate. Okay? And I can construct a sort of free energy landscape for this. It's going to be something like this. So I'm sort of following this ideology.
But I don't know. Because when you take this picture, then you assume that the sticking energy is larger than log n times kt. Because that is the entropic barrier you have to overcome.
Yeah, so there's entropic.
Because if you make a change long enough, eventually you will always have to go up to a plateau rather than into a next valley.
Oh, exactly. So this is my entropic barrier, right? So I have to bring them together, and that's the entropic barrier, right?
I'm telling you.
Yeah, but my problem is that your minimum on the other side is below the other one. I would expect it to be much higher, typically.
Fine. I don't care what is minimum, so I don't care. Yeah, but fine, yeah. So now I want to describe, now one thing that is known for this process, that is the answer that is, you know, can get from simulations and from whatnot, the answer is that this is going to scale as Forel's model is n to minus 2. Okay?
That's equilibrium constant?
No, that's the rate.
Oh, okay.
So, probably like the first path to Stein.
But how did you get that from just applying that equation, basically?
No, I did not apply anything. So this I get by solving the full problem.
Huh.
So just calculating the mean first passage time by whatever means,
numerically, but for the Rouse model.
For the Rouse model, yeah. Right now, I'm not arguing that Rouse model is a good model. I'm just saying that it's a Rouse model. So that's the answer. Now, imagine that I want to now describe it in terms of one-dimensional picture. So first of all, I would say, well, obviously, I have this potential mean force, which is trivially computed with entropic barrier here and so on. But then the question is, so I want to write some kind of Langevin equation for this. What's the diffusivity?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, first of all, let me say this. So if I were to stop at this stage here, I can easily show that this model is equivalent to simply two things connected by a single spring. Okay, because the probability distribution between
everything's Gaussian.
This is Gaussian, so this is Gaussian, so that's it. Okay. So this is a famous.
Plus the sticking potential, because you seem to.
Plus, you can put some sticking potential on top of that. Right, so it's the same sticking potential. If the sticking potential only has to put these two guys, then it's going to be two things by spring plus the sticking potential. And so this famous Doi model, I think, Dunbar model, whatever you call that. So then I can also calculate all the correlation function of this thing. Okay? So I can calculate the say. And I take the vector so we don't have to deal with how many things. And it's going to be sum of e to minus tau over tau n times some stuff. And these are relaxation times, okay? And one thing I want to point out is that this thing is going to be dominated by the longest relaxation time scale. So 90% of this correlation function is going to be contained in the slowest mode, okay? So that tells me that in a sense, this R is a slow mode because it's almost the same. Now, then I can also ask the question. So if it's the slowest, so I can calculate the relaxation time of this thing, right? And if I assume simple friction coefficient, then the rotation time of this, and with the screen constant here, the rotation time of this is going to be simply gamma divided by screen constant. Okay? And on the other hand, I also know the slow rotation time of this by solving the Rouse model, and that's going to be something like R squared divided by translation diffusion constant of this. I can equate these two to each other, and it's going to tell me what the friction constant is. If I do that, I'm going to find out that the friction constant for this would be something like the monomer friction constant times the refrigerator,
which is something that you have.
So essentially, what I'm saying is that the effective friction constant for this construct, if I want to match this correlation function, should be simply monomer friction constant times the number of monomers. Okay? Now, after that, I'm going to take this, and I'm going to stick it into the Kramers formula, and calculate the rate.
So everything seems to be okay.
And by the way, this thing is known in chemistry as Zabel-Shulton theory, and I think Dory has, I think Zabel-Shulton basically rediscovered what Dory had in his very old paper. But anyway. At the end of the day, if you do all that, you can find out that k goes as n to minus 5 over 2, which is wrong. So now the question is, and it's been well recognized again, so it's an evolution. So the solution is that actually, even though you have 90% here, you cannot neglect the remaining 10%. So basically, the problem is that the dynamics along R is highly monomorphic, and you cannot ignore this fact.
Now, that's just an example, is that the spectrum of relaxation times isn't just a lot of stuff here, a lot of stuff here, and a gap in the middle where it could then cut.
Well, but what I'm arguing that this is sort of a, this is a very common situation. I mean, if you, it's hard to find a situation where it's not the case. So I'll tell you, but the question is, my challenge to you is that, so suppose that you know, this is of course a trivial problem, so you can solve it, you don't need all this stuff. But suppose that you really want to fix this, and suppose you want to get this right result using this simple picture. So suppose that you're simply watching the dynamics of this end-to-end distance of the chain, R, and of course you know the potential of being force, you know everything. What is the correct equation to write down that will describe these dynamics? And I don't know the answer. And that's why I asked you in the beginning, because I'm not even sure that I can write down some kind of generalized Langevin equation that's going to give you these dynamics. I mean, why? There's no reason.
Marcy was right. There's no separation of time scales in this problem.
But what do you
mean? I mean, the realization time scales with the Rouse model, right? So
yeah,
it's very clearly not a separation of time scales.
I agree with that completely. But again, you have to be very careful when you're talking about separation of time scales, because again, so it's not enough.
If there's no separation of time scales, that would mean you can't properly even define that rate constant in the first place. So is that really true? Or is it that this particular degree of freedom is not separated from the other?
Well, I don't know any other thing which is, there's obviously one degree of freedom that is the best, I mean, the best slow coordinate is going to be your slowest Rouse mode, right? So that's a
projected dynamics onto R, right? So the best slow variable is the lowest eigenfunction of the whole space.
That's right. Right? Okay, so that's the slow
which problem. May not have anything to do with R.
Exactly. That's right. So you're correct. The slowest mode here, which is completely separable from the S, is your slowest Rouse mode. We know that.
Right.
But the problem is that
it doesn't have projection on it.
Right. So the projection is defined better than this one. So.
Yeah. So I mean, the question still, you know, is it true that there's no rate constant for this problem? In which case, there really is no time scale separation. Or is
no,
there,
I think there's something.
This R.
There is a time scale separation in terms of an unfolded and a folded.
Right. Yeah.
Of course, there is.
Yeah, there is.
So I think the question goes back then to, we need to find something other than R, and you will capture this with the simple picture. We just don't know what it is.
Maybe, but I'm not saying it's incorrect. But yes, there are two questions here. One question for me is that I still don't know. Suppose that I have this coordinate, right, and I'm stuck with it. Is there a simple one-dimensional equation that would make sense?
And I have the suspicion we're talking about two very different questions here.
Yeah, I also think.
You're posing the question that, what if I have a really complicated system? I don't want to bother with this really complicated system. I try to find simple, slow variables. And there might be simple and smaller. But if those are not the only slow variables, or if they're not good separation timescales, I wouldn't even know how to start to crank more once again in this. There's always memory in the system, and that's very hard to deal with.
What I'm saying is that, again, so you should not, this equation has nothing to do with Swansea Morin.
No, but I think Marcus is right. I mean, you're trying to solve the opposite problem. So given a coordinate, what is the equation that belongs to it? We want to solve, what is the best coordinate for that particular equation?
Fine. So if you don't want to solve my problem, the question I want to emphasize is that even if you have the best coordinate you like, I'm not convinced that you should be able to write this equation.
No, I don't think that's correct, because your coordinate is not a good coordinate.
No, even if it's the best possible coordinate.
But you haven't proved it.
You haven't convinced us.
Somebody plays devil's advocate for you, Dima. So the underlying dynamics do satisfy an equation like this. So if you could actually find the right coordinate, why would you get something other than...
because I projected out a bunch of stuff. So you're right. Underlying dynamics, of course, satisfies the Lagrange equation. But once I project it out,
what other kinds of dynamics would you get then? You would get some ballistic characters from...
I have no idea, because, like I said, I only know two cases where this can be derived. Case number one is that when you have a system coupled to a bunch of harmonic oscillators, when I integrate out harmonic oscillators, I'm going to get, generally speaking, a memory kernel here, but it's going to be still a Lagrange equation.
And in that example, if you choose the coordinate right, you get that equation here.
Yeah, right. Now, the second case, if the coupling is weak, I can use linear response, and I end up, everything's harmonic oscillator there again, and you get the same answer with the memory. But generally speaking, I mean, why should you even get this Lagrange equation? I mean, you're in a world where, the reason why we all like to use this equation is simply because it gives you the correct equilibrium distribution, right? And it has some gamma we can sort of tells you how fast or how slow things go. But I don't know if there's any derivation of that. Now, Swansea-Morin is a systematic procedure, but it gives you a different equation. Swansea-Morin, this is all of the harmonic oscillator. And all the funny stuff is happening here, because this has a lot of memory. So it's a different construct.
Then you can also show that if you take the Markovian assumption, so you are getting back into the Markov dynamics.
But why does the Markovian assumption
work?
Well, we're coming back to the question that he actually wants.
That's what you want.
If we are in a situation where, for whatever reason, a small number of coarse grain variables properly describes the system in a memory-free way, even then, if I haven't found them all, I'm getting totally messy dynamics. So the system is nice to me. So it could just be the case, there's two variables that describe the whole damn thing. I only found one, and everything's messy.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to A, recognize that situation, and B, find this other second magic variable?
Sure,
that's
yeah.
The problem is simple. You're going to tell me there are situations where you can't even find that thing, which is a different problem, it seems.
Fine, and like I said, if you don't think that is because to me that is the problem, because until I get to that point, but if you don't want to deal with that problem, let's go back. So tell me what's the correct direction coordinate in this case.
Well, maybe you look up a talk on April 9 by Ralph Everest where he looked into this question as well. Yeah, you can look it up on the web pages. Okay. Then we can come back to Peter.
Okay, I'll look
at
that. Yeah.
Anyway, so that's my question.
That's a question. But yeah, I think that the original question that I posed is also still important, and that is not what is the correct equation for that one, or is that actually the reaction coordinate, but how can we actually employ the framework of recognizing wrong or good reaction coordinates for improving coarse-grained variables? Because I think that might be useful for also for the coarse-grained community. Because if you are if you have a molecule like your polymer, for example, and you trace it by beads, you also throw out information, you throw out degrees of freedom, and usually you don't care about the dynamical aspects, but they are important, of course. I mean, you assume that everything you throw out was fast, but what indeed if something you throw out was actually slow? And that is actually something that you cannot immediately recognize, because it doesn't come out from the radial distribution function, and it doesn't come out from the thermodynamics, so it only comes out through the dynamics. And how do you recognize that? And I would say, well, maybe there is a way, and I'm still thinking about that, I guess, but there is a way using these analysis tools also for this. So how do you actually use it in this framework where you have this coarse grain R, where you actually put the corrected variables for your coarse grain force field, and how can you test them then this is a correct dynamical on a dynamical basis? So I only have very vague ideas about it, but maybe you have something to add to that, or
you seem to be saying that maybe I should, I'm not sure which, I mean, this is a chicken and egg problem somehow. We say from a dynamical point of view, I first have to figure out what are the appropriate dynamical variables that are slower than everything else in the system, so those I need to describe. Yeah. After you made that decision, you write down the coarse grain step, and then you write down, but then you need to check back that the whatever Langevin equation then would like to get for that actually reproduces the dynamics you started with. So which way do you?
Well, I mean, but you actually pointed out the recipe for that, so you have to do it that way. So you actually say, I'm going to reproduce my thermodynamics using that formalism, then I'm making a coarse grain dynamics from it, and then I test this coarse grain dynamics using whatever tools that you want to do it. And if it doesn't come out correctly, you can actually try to improve on it by adding more degrees of freedom back in, or taking a different coarse grain variable. So I mean, as an example, I actually follow what Darren and I were talking about last week, the ion pair dissociation, which is actually a classic problem physical chemistry. So if we have a solution with ions in it, so here is lots of water. So now I have to be careful. Yeah, like this. And and these ions can, of course, they attract each other. So there is a state where they are pairing, and because of entropy, there's also a state where they are unpairing. And so there is a potential mean force or a free energy as a function of R, and I would take R as my coordinate, which looks like this. So it's typical two-state behavior. And so you might say, okay, I'm going to coarse grain this by just saying I have this is my potential mean force, and this should describe all dynamics. This is absolutely not true, because it turns out that the solvent participates in this process, because you can imagine when these things are so small, the ions are really, really small, and when they actually come close together, the coordination shells of the molecules start to interact. So this actually has a certain influence on the dynamics. So also on the diffusion, for example. So I would say, well, if you can write, you can analyze this with a
with two ion pairs. Why not, for example, with a whole solution of ions? So an electrolyte, for example. And would it be possible, or would it be even be useful, actually, to do that? So you coarse grain your electrolyte by a primitive model, but you don't get the dynamics right, just because of this type of...
Well, for one thing, we'll back at Gary's remark that you kill hydrodynamics.
Yeah. So you have to put down it as well. So the question, I mean, maybe...
Well, is that the one thing you see, you do this and it doesn't come out right, well, what is missing? I mean, what comes out wrong? Is that simply hydrodynamics, or is there something else you're missing?
Yeah, that's actually a good point. Yeah, you're right, and this maybe is not a good example because you have...
You can get hydrodynamics back from coarse grain, it's just you won't have a diagonal equation like that. It has like an OC coupling all the degrees of freedom.
But your problem is not for hydrodynamics, isn't it? The problem that when these ions come very close to each other, the hydration shells get distorted.
Yes, that's the problem. They have competing...
You pull them a little bit apart, and then the molecules have to piece one by one, so to speak, come in. Yeah. So it's much more a local problem than the typical long-range hydrodynamics. It's a pecking problem of molecules.
Right, but that should all be in the WMR.
No, that's not. So
why is it not? If I calculate the potential of mean force between two ions in water, everything involving hydration shells is part of that potential.
That's true, but it has the same
requiring the hydration shells. Projected on R, though.
It's the wrong projection. If you project on R, you miss out orthogonal degrees of freedom.
It's all in there, in the projection, onto R. But, you know, the question again, just like Dima's problem is, R doesn't seem to be the right thing. I mean, you can, as Peter, and well, I guess this was Fiddle, Geisler, Geisler, right, to show that that the committer is not peaked at 1/2 of this problem.
Yeah, so I mean, I agree that, of course, this, I mean, if you want to describe this properly, you actually have to reintroduce the hydrodynamics at some point. But I think maybe this is a good toy problem because, sort of toy problem, because here you can clearly see that even if you, this is the obvious degree of freedom, R, and you miss out solvent degrees of freedom, which you somehow have to put in again. And of course, you could put in a model that would actually give you some more complicated, higher dimensional free energy. But can you then use this? Is that possible to use that in a coarse grain simulation? So that's actually the question that I'm asking. And if so, would that be useful?
The next question might ask, what other variables might there be? If you want to describe on the coarse grain level, the system, on the coarse grain level, there's really only one variable, R. What else could you now put in?
Yeah, but this is exactly the point.
Well, you don't want to put individual water molecules in that one by one. What you want is some sort of continuum representation of water. Yeah. So one thing you could say, well, I have a local water field that tells me where locally the water, even if you say there's a density field, there's a water parameter field, and that field has modes by which it evolves. And these modes have wavelengths and which decay on certain scales. And if there's a mode of that field which has a wavelength comparable to R, and there probably is if they're close, then the question is if I excite such a mode, how long does it take for that mode to go away? That might be a small variable.
Yeah.
So what you need in your coarse grain description is some sort of evolution equation for that field. There's no guarantee that that's.
Now, that's a good point, of course. So the variable that you, so here the variable R is easily transformed into a Langevin equation. But if you have, for example, I mean, I'm not talking about fields, but something much more simpler, the coordination number, which might actually be involved. And even if that coordination number, you need an equation motion for that coordination number. And
but that seems to be like a discrete variable.
No, exactly. But I'm saying this is not going to be, that, so that actually complicates things tremendously.
That's going to be a long range variable too, because
of the electrostatics. Yeah. Okay, so maybe this is actually not such a good example.
Well, let's stay for there for a second. You said one thing which I probably disagree with, but I'm not sure whether this is important in this context or not. Occasionally I feel it is from a practical point of view. You said, well, energetically it will have to be coarse.
Yeah.
but from entropy reason, they're likely to be fall apart. And that's the usual energy entropy gun, which is always like a thing about it. Mm-hmm. I think in that case, I mean, one of the reasons why they also want to be close is entropy, because if you work out the whole dielectric blah, blah, blah of water, there's a lot of entropy in electrostatic interactions.
Yeah, this is true.
And I was wondering whether if you, these free energy problems, to my experience, working with like free energy problems and sampling things, if you have an energetic minimum versus an entropic minimum, that makes a hell of a difference in terms of anything that you want to sample.
That's absolutely true.
I wonder whether these kinds of issues play in here or whether they are.
Well, I think you're right, actually, that even if you, you're right that on an energetic level, of course, this is the contact pair is preferred and this is not. By definition,
there are be energetically. That if this is a plus or minus, then being close is not preferred.
Plus and minus close?
Yes, it's not preferred.
Awesome. I think it is.
Because if you work out what electrostatic interactions in water are...
Well, you mean the hydration shells have to overlap and that actually causes...
I'm not even talking about hydration, you can even look at the large distance limit. The tricky thing is because the electrostatics in water, the way you write it down with the dielectric constant, you tend to forget that the dielectric constant depends on temperature. Therefore, what you really write down is the free energy of interaction.
Yeah.
You could ask yourself, well, if this is an F, how much E and how much S is it? And you can work this easily apart because you know the temperature dependence of the dielectric constant. What you're going to find is that the energetic part has the wrong sign compared to what you expect. So energetically, a plus and a minus in water, become. The reason why they still attract is because there's a shitload of entropy on top of it that makes it all right.
The entropy of the water.
Yeah.
The translational entropy.
The whole rest of the polarization of the entire water thing around it's going to make it right. And so there's a lot of really crazy entropy going on that makes electrostatics in water by a factor of 80 smaller. But just for the sign to come out right, you would.
Okay.
I'm worried whether these things matter or not.
Yeah,
they might not be.
For the discussion, it probably doesn't matter. But for the.
Not the details that it's kind of funny in the wrong sign, but the fact that even the minimum in this thing, the attraction, all of this is entropy, and entropy kind of is always misbehaving when you sample. I wonder.
Unless it's actually very easily sampled, like in homogeneous fluids. I mean, that's. Easy thing to say.
People have looked at taking this free energy curve and also computing an average energy curve, which you can do along the way, and you do see that the entropy has a contribution to the stabilization of the first well, which is definitely counterintuitive. But yeah, I think it's true that it's a big part of the picture.
Is this already about that?
For example, in work by DeLago. I don't know if that's available yet.
So you are saying it's not textbook knowledge, it's something that is just being discovered?
I think that McCammon also did some work on this.
What I just told you is textbook knowledge.
It is, yeah.
Yeah, that's in the old Call by the Domain textbook by Menestrom. And what was the other guy?
Menestrom.
Okay.
I should read it then.
So it's a homework problem. Christian and Berghess did work on, what was that? The pair potentials of things in one, they took this all apart. Do you remember what that
3 years ago, 2004, 5, something like this.
Okay. So as I said, this might be not the right example to think about. But
it's a good example coming back to the fields thing that I brought up, that if you have a long-range variable embedded in a field that you're coarse-grained away, of course there's every expectation that the field will have a mode of the same wavelength as the long-range variable, and you cannot assume that that's going to be fast. So what would we, and it has a contribution under the magnitude, but it might also have a contribution like thermodynamically, because the order gravity fields do fucking things.
But your big point is that you don't want to do this because it actually horribly complicates.
Not necessarily. I mean, some people just decide that. I mean, there's a lot of work of hydrodynamic by just putting another Stokes solver somewhere on a lattice or anything. I mean, there's just all these people doing this, And why would you couple a particle-based theory to a continuum theory? This is also messy. Well, it is. If you do it right, it's more efficient. So it might require some sort of coding or just collaborating with someone who does all the coding for you. But it might be a faster way of doing it. And if already if someone already has a code that can deal with these kind of funny fields, putting a good dynamical equation for these things in there and then seeing whether the lowest few modes of that field capture everything you want to know in terms of dynamic might not even be that hard.
So I think that it's you know, it's still important to remember, though, that you know, even though the variables may be more complicated than what people have thought about in the past in terms of involving long-range fields, I think that you know, there are variational theorems that say if your estimate with the coordinate that you projected onto already has this separation of timescales, which is your the ratio of those timescales is your rate, right? Then that is only gonna get more separated if you have the right variable, right? So on the transition theory end of things, you have the variational transition state theory, and as you go over to the Kramer's limit, you have Berezovsky's envelope. So both cases, you know, the better job you do at choosing the coordinate to do your projection onto, the more separated these timescales get, and it still has this characteristic that R is not doing a good job describing.
No, but I think what I see a practical problem is indeed if you have to induce lots of long range fields and parameter fields, then it will be very hard. I mean, much harder, I think, than that particular equation that is just acting on some Cartesian coordinates. So you really have to write down some equations of motion for the field involved in the solution, which is much more complicated, possibly. I think so.
Well, I mean, you know, I know that this may be downright offensive to the very sophisticated things that people do in this audience, but, you know, the simple-minded solution that I would take to test for this is to find the coordinate with the short-range effects described well, and then, you know, make my box, you know, five times bigger and see whether the dynamics are well described with the diffusion and the free energy that I got from the small simulation. And, you know, if you keep getting the same answers, your simulation gets bigger, then the long-range stuff, I would assume, is not really important to the process. So, I mean, you know, I guess the process of searching for these things, even when we can't immediately tackle the long-range hydrodynamics, is still a worthwhile endeavor.
I don't think Peter's talking about the finite size effect.
No, I was thinking about the projection of all the water molecules from some sort of parameter field, just as Marcus actually was proposing as a solution. Maybe we should actually wrap up the discussion. I don't know. Or did anyone want to say anything?
Does anyone have a solution?
Have a solution? I think it's actually worth thinking about. Because, I mean, just as a last problem, then. So if you would have a protein, and you would, this would be your protein, and these proteins have internal degrees of freedom, obviously, and you want to represent a solution of proteins, say a cell, by means of Borgmann. Now, obviously, this will be horribly complex. So what would you choose as an R? Would you choose the full globular protein position and maybe orientation? Or would you take a domain description or a backbone description or a side chain description or something in between? Or, I mean, so this is the kind of stuff that you actually should be thinking about, I think. So if you have a very complex system in need of biomolecules, it actually can be described in different length and time scales with different degrees of freedom. I mean, you have to be able to not only get structure right, but also the dynamics. And I think that it should be possible
somehow to optimize.
By the way, one comment on your protein example. So one interesting thing that happens if you try to eliminate, so imagine you have protein and some in vacuum, okay? So there's no water. And I just say I'm gonna take C alphas to be my coarse grain variables. So if you actually coarse grain them out, you're gonna end up with interactions which look like hydrodynamic interactions, even though you have no water. They don't come from water, they come from the fact that you eliminate out of the figure. So that goes back to the same issue that you can't simply write down the Langevin equation.
You have hydrodynamic interactions between the proteins?
No, they don't come
as pieces of the same protein.
Right, so, but these hydrodynamic interactions don't come from water.
I'm still not understanding. You have hydrodynamic interactions between what?
So suppose that I have a full protein, full atom.
Yeah.
And instead of using four atoms, I'm going to say I have one atom per
galaxy.
So I construct a model, and I simply eliminate the atom degrees of freedom. Ask the question, what are the correct equations of motion that govern the dynamics of the coarse grain system?
You said you get hydrodynamic interactions, and I was asking between what? The C alphas?
Between C alphas,
the same protein?
Yes.
So the conclusion of all of this is that we're not only have to worry about what degrees of freedom we have to integrate out, but we also need the right dynamical equation for it. And I think that's right. Maybe you should stick with the
board. So if I could add one little thing, I was hoping to turn to have a student of mine talk about this, but we have done some work trying to find the right coordinate to use, the one that describes this committer probability quite well. And what we find is that when you do it, and you construct the free energy landscape, you construct the coordinate-dependent diffusivity, the Shmolkowski equation and the real dynamics just map perfectly onto each other. It really does a nice job. So Brandon Knott has done this. So I have to put a caveat on this, that the kinds of problems that we work on are nucleation problems, where Gibbs told us to look for coordinates like nucleus size of some sort. So it's not a wide open space like some of the coordinate searches that you guys have talked about today. We already know roughly what kinds of things we should be looking for, but you know, indeed, the process does work quite well at giving you a mini body problem that follows the phenomenological equation if you have the right coordinate. And I think it's quite nice to see, you know, the variances predicted by the Shmolkowski equation. You plot them right next to the ones from the simulation, and they just track each other perfectly.
Okay. Does anyone have to add anything to that? Then I think that we should have some coffee or something.